September 11th, we were living with an unrealistic view of our world, much like observing Europe appease Hitler, or trying to accommodate the Soviet Union through the use of mutually assured destruction. President Bush decided that we could no longer just be on defense against global terrorism, we must also be on offense. On September 20th, 2001, President Bush stood before a joint session of Congress, a still grieving and shocked nation, and a confused world, and he changed the direction of our ship of state. He dedicated America, under his leadership, to destroying global terrorism. The president announced the Bush Doctrine, when he said, "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it doesn't end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." Either you are with us.
Shut the hell up, Giuliani, talking about you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. Well, that's a no-win situation, because if you're with Sam, you're definitely with the terrorists. And then you babble out on September 20th, Boy George stood in front of a confused world. What the hell are you talking about? The world was singing Malcolm's song, "The Chickens Have Come Home to Roost." And if you want to see some confused look, not in the world, look at the eyes of Boy George on September 11th after the planes hit while the students were reading him nursery books. And then you babble out, Boy George decided we could no longer just be in defense against global terrorism. We must go on the offense. Well, with a new order of head coffins being ordered to me every day by your own G.I. Joe heroes, I don't know how well this strategy is working for you all. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this out. Listening to 104.1, 101.1, Santa Cruz, 106.7, Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, and RadioForAll.net, the universe, Slave of Old Time. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into a little quick update on the sports issue of basketball and other sports in the Olympics. Then we're going to shoot right into Adventures in Corporate Media Land segment, as we're going to deal with the issue of the war president and what that means in the imperial scheme of things. And then Joe's going to wrap it up on the Making It Plain news update. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1. Slave. We vote. Thank you.
America, home of the free, land of the brave. You will tell me to be your messenger of death, your emissary of war, your harbinger of destruction. You will teach me to kill. And teach me well.
When I was a lad, we had indentured bond servants. Stout Cornishmen and Scotsmen.
Indeed, sir, indeed. And if one of them runs away, you couldn't tell him from any other Englishman.
But take a black slave, sir. By Harry, no matter how far they run, they're always black. Take a black slave, sir. By Harry, no matter how far they run, they're always black. Always black. Always black. Always black. By Harry, no matter how far they run, they're always black.
Never forget to see travelers. It only destroys. Fire does. In time, truth is colder than the way things are. Chilling, isn't it? Can you conceive through that ashen shroud of hope where those enchanted embers may lead one? Go on, look. Can you see there beyond sense?
All right, first what we're going to start off is a kind of a quick Ruins of Empire segment dealing with what transpired at the Olympics. As many people know, the NBA players went over to the Olympics and lost in a little game and basically got a bronze medal. They were expected by many people, not all, but by many people to win the gold. And there's been various speculation on what could have happened. And some people have made predictions about what are going to be some of those ramifications. Joe, you got anything you want to add about this?
Oh, yeah, I certainly do. I was surprised to actually see a poll of patriotic Americans, so-called. And the poll said that 54.1% of the approximately 20,000 respondents claimed that they wanted to see USA team lose. This was before they lost, y'all. This is not no, you know, sour grapes afterwards. And another 19.9% said they, quote, kind of wanted Team USA to lose. So what's going on? And all of a sudden, the media, which is never, ever stroking any class consciousness that I ever see, points out that these are millionaires and what do they care about us anyway? Well, let's deal with some facts. Because it's unfair the way the media has been dealing with these NBA players. And it's not like they need me to defend them. I mean, but the facts are, you do need a special type of team to play this game. And that is, you need people that have played together for some time. They need to be acclimated to the international rules, which are quite different than the NBA. You know, you damn near got to be tackled in the NBA to get a foul called on, especially when you're banging underneath the hoop. Don't nobody call no fouls on. If they call these kind of fouls for people bumping into each other, Shaq wouldn't last but about 10 minutes of a game. He'd be gone every game. So, that's right. Not just Shaq, Tracy points out. No, the game is played a lot rougher in the United States, okay? And people get used to that. So you have to be deprogrammed in order to play according to this international standard. You see what I'm saying? And at least you have to play together for some amount of time with people that know how to play that way. It's a different game. The three-point line is closer. Long shots are way more, three-point shots way more important in the international style of play than in the NBA, for instance. So what are you getting here? What we're getting is people venting at black people. I'm sorry. I'm not, you know, we don't have to use a whole lot of fancy sociology here. The whole Team USA was black. And there are people, believe it or not, who don't like that. The black. That's it. We ain't got to get all sophisticated. What do you say,
Sam? It's fascinating that, a couple of months before, when Larry Bird said that it would probably energize NBA fans if there were some more white superstars, and many white folks jumped all over him. But the facts bear out that a lot of this attitude towards the NBA players down in the Olympics was racially motivated. Now, what's kind of corny about how some of this stuff has come about is because in many ways, their defeat had nothing to do with the players. In part, it has to do with the arrogance and the structure of how U.S. Not only basketball teams are put together, but how the U.S. approaches many team sports. Not all team sports, but many team sports. Let's take track, for example. There's no doubt if you watch, like, the 100 meter, the U.S. got Gatlin got the gold. Another brother got the bronze. So they had the two fastest out of the three fastest runners in the world. They had two of the fastest, and then they had a bunch of others that were right there with them, which basically said in everyone's analysis that the U.S. has the overwhelming amount of speed in the world. Now, you know, individually. But what happened in the 4x100s? Instead of putting a team together systematically, well before they get to the Olympics, right, they let them all play off of one another, who's going to get one spot, what if you have 1/100th of a second in your last running, you may take the spot of someone else, and
ridiculous,
all of this.
Right.
Meanwhile, everyone else has already consolidated their team and has been working on the baton.
Excellent.
So what happened? They do the 4x100s,
drop
the males bounce into one another, and then the next thing you know, here comes Britain zooming off into the sunset and taking the taking the gold home. The U.S. comes in second, and it was clearly because they were stumbling all over each other. Now, one can't say, oh, it's just the Negroes, because if you look at the British team, guess what? All Negroes. Sorry, we everywhere. You know, the whole British team was. Now take the women's 4x100. Once again, they were expected to win. Overwhelming speed. If you compare their team scores or their individual scores compared to all other countries, once again, they had the overwhelming amount of speed. Once again, they look like Keystone Cops, bumping into each other, crashing out the lane, and this time it was like Jamaica or someone who zoomed off and got the gold. Now, what is somewhat comical about this is I always watch the track and field stuff, and I always have a little smirk on my face when the U.S. Track team is about to do the team type sport, you know, pass the baton, because it's always an adventure. Because just like 6 months before this Olympics, the U.S. was in France at the International. And once again, the U.S. women's team had the overall team speed. They were expected to win, so on and so forth. But once again, they didn't have a team till the last second. And this time, when they're bobbling and dropping the baton and running over each other, France hands it off like water and zooms off to the victory. Once again, this is a national thing, because you can't say it's just the Negroes, you know, because the whole French female team, all Negroes. That's the real world. this year in boxing. Now, this is even though this is an individual, it still gets to the way the U.S. approaches stuff. The U.S. only got one gold out of all the boxing. The brother Ward from Oakland, he's the only one who got the gold medal. Now, many people have talked what has happened to American boxing, in especially in these little amateur fights. Now, as even one of the guys who's a specialist in American boxing has said, look, the U.S. does not prepare its boxers for amateur international sports. It just, you know, this feels it can just go in there. It prepares them for pro, but it doesn't prepare them for the international game. And then they try to just come into the Olympics with a pro type of approach, and it just doesn't work. And Sam is so arrogant that the Cubans, who won like 5 gold medals in the boxing, they offered the U.S. to come over and train with their boxers so that they can both get under international rules, so they can both get some experience. Sam said, nah, get out of here, Fidel. So Fidel just put strap back on his boots, gave a kiss to the Che pitchers, and got his boys in the gym, you know, did their thing, and just got their goals, you know, their own way. So what I'm saying, in many ways, the downfall, quote unquote, of some of these team sports with the U.S. has more to do with the arrogance of the bodies that are in charge in putting these teams together. Just last year, the U.S. went out and played internationally, the American basketball team. They averaged beating those same teams by an average of 27 points. But this year, many Negroes didn't want to go for the right reason. They thought they may get shot up or just didn't want to, you know, raise the flag. And but instead of putting together a team that would fit the international game, put on shooters and other things, they just put together a bunch of guys, you know, got players of the future, you know, who aren't fully developed. It was just like a social type of thing.
Yeah.
And,
predictable results. I tell you what, let's just put this in historical context, because y'all think we're picking on old Sam. Well, you know what? I'd like to pick until he stopped bleeding. But anyway, truth of the matter is, did y'all ever hear of Jesse Owens? How many medals did Jesse Owens win in the 1936 Olympics? Crazy.
I think it was 4.
Uh-huh. Something like that. And you know what? Homeboy had to come back to this mess. And here's a quote of what he said when he came back after winning multiple gold medals for the United States. I quote, this is Jesse Owens. When I came back to my native country, after all the stories about Hitler, I couldn't ride in the front of the bus, Owens said. I had to go to the back door. I couldn't live where I wanted. I wasn't invited to shake hands with Hitler, but I wasn't invited to shake hands in the White House or the president either.
You're the Hitler.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you what. Proof that this is a racist impulse is, let me give you this. Just think about this, brothers and sisters. Yes, the American team won a bronze medal. I'm glad they got that, because these fools might have been out there spitting at the people when they got off the plane. Iverson and them, when they got off the plane. But more.
Well, Iverson has enough sense to be strapped.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Probably wouldn't get away with that with my man. But truth be told, when has the Soviet Union stopped whooping on the American team? When have they stopped whooping on them? Every time I see they play the American team in international competition, they whooped on them except the one time, and they made a movie about that.
Are you talking about hockey?
Yeah. Well, you know, they have world competition in hockey, and don't nobody be talking that foolishness about them losing. I mean, them losing a game.
Oh, I know, but, you know, hockey is not really considered an American-type game.
Hey, no, but you know what?
In the same way that basketball.
But let me tell you, they use hockey to displace basketball. They started that in the 70s when these, let's say, racists started writing in and talking about they didn't want to support no teams that were all black. They started writing letters to the editor.
What does that have to do about Russia, though?
Well, the thing is, Russia been whooping on the Americans as long as I can remember.
Not in basketball.
No, in hockey. But ain't nobody complaining about that.
Oh, I know, but like I said, hockey, I mean, it wasn't that long ago when America didn't even have a pro hockey sport. I mean, they don't really even care that much about soccer. You know, if the American men did or didn't win soccer, especially, you know, in bygone years at the Olympics, they don't really care about that. They really don't care unless they can really point the fingers on a certain, quote-unquote, hot-button issues at the time.
That's right. Well, just one last little thing I do want to mention about the sports thing that caught my eye. I couldn't give it up. Now, once again, this is just racism in sports generally. This is true. This happened. So I didn't want to interpret it. I first want to read it to you. You tell me what's going on. This is a quote from one of these female golfers, okay, involved in this lady PGA, whatever they call the thing. And I quote, she's complaining about the fact that too many Asians have been winning in the games. Listen to her. And I quote, this is probably going to be get me in trouble, but the Asians are killing our tour. Absolutely killing it. Their lack of emotion, their refusal to speak English when they can speak English. They rarely speak. We have two-day programs where people are paying lots of money to play with us, and they say hello and goodbye. Our tour is predominantly international, and the majority of them are Asian. They've taken it over. She ain't through yet. If I were commissioner, I would have a quota on international players that would include a quota on Asian players, she concluded, she said. As it is, they're taking American money. American sponsors are picking up the bill. There should be a qualifying school for Americans and a qualifying school for international players. I'm Australian, an international player, but I say America has to come first. 60% of the tour should be American, 40% international. Well, let me show you something about this crazy racist. The reality is many of the Asians that she's talking about are Americans. They just quiet people. That's their disposition. Now, I can see if she said, well, you know, they got to go. We got to have some media workshops for them to learn how to work with. That's cool. I ain't saying nobody's perfect. But this was actually stated.
Well, first of all, I haven't heard even the public complaining about it.
No. You haven't. You know why?
So she's this is a sour grape.
Oh, a loser. Oh, absolutely.
She's just getting whipped up.
But that racism, that's the thing. That racism. And by the way, 6 announcers in the Olympics out of roughly, 3,000? I'm through. Black announcers.
Hold on a second.
The media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth? The media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth?
They lie.
Everything that fast?
Now
how things are about to get out of hand. And for people like these, an incredible weapon has been created. Power of a computer in the palm of your hand.
You know what time it is now. Ventures in corporate media land. And what we're going to deal with tonight is how the corporate media and other myth makers play into this image of the war president. You know, this is the mythological hero, Zeus-like hero, where when there's a war going on, the president takes on the protective father type role, where he's like John Wayne, white savior of the universe, who, amongst all other things, we should give the benefit of the doubt, not be too ridiculing against. After all, he's out saving the world. He's out saving the cause. Well, on NPR show Talk of the Nation, Neil Cohen talks to David Greenberg about some of these issues. And they get into this John Wayne mythological war hero, war president type stuff. And we'll break down what it really means in the real imperialist world. Check this out.
So, war president seems to carry a fair amount of freight. Of course, it, you know, logically, it's a president who's president during a war, but what else does it connote symbolically?
Well, I think what we look for in a military leader are traits that are different from those we typically look for in a president. But when the nation is at war, we want the president to exhibit more of those general-like qualities. Tough, decisive leadership, the ability to unite a people behind him, quick, tough decision-making, a certain, you know, the qualities of Bush's that he touts, his so-called moral clarity. Those are the qualities I think we associate with a war president, whereas a domestic peacetime leader will brag about different traits.
Well, might not war leadership also encompass qualities like skillfully maneuvering an international alliance?
Well, certainly, yeah, and John Kerry's challenge in this campaign has been to also portray himself as a credible wartime leader, while at the same time not trying to outbush Bush. He realizes that his own traits are different ones that he can bring to bear, and so things like rebuilding our alliances, a more prudent brand of wartime leadership, is what's going to bring voters over to his side.
Now, when you listen to that, these have all of the manifestations of being a gump following an imperialist president like a drone without questioning. Because after all, if you buy into this whole thing that someone is being quote unquote a war president because he's uniting us, not analyzing on what class line is he quote unquote uniting you, and should you be questioning the fact that he may be uniting you to getting involved in some action that is fundamentally against the overall working class interests of the masses of people throughout the world. and basically the humanitarian interests of the masses of people in humanity when they're tossing things like depleted uranium around. But they get into this whole thing about Bush has taken on some of these issues because of his moral clarity. This is just rhetoric. I mean, it's more than clear that Boy George has helped manipulate the topic. He has distorted the facts and used them to justify an unjustifiable war for his own interest that he serves. Now, what moral clarity does that have outside of being obedient to a ruling class that is fundamentally should be against the masses of people who are at least conscious out there? Now, they also said this stuff about quick decision making. Well, anyone who's seen Michael Moore's 9-1-1 Fahrenheit movie, when Boy George is told about the attacks, and watch the little glazed over eyes as Boy George looks befuddled about what to do next. How anyone can even pretend that he's someone, you know, up on his feet with quick decision making. This is mythology. This is what I mean. This whole war president stuff takes on almost a Hollywood type of imagery that says that those who are commanders of the U.S. empire are out doing justice to calm the savages throughout the world.
You know what? I used to think that people that tried to utilize parallels in 1984 were over the top, overdoing it. But these people are so raw in their approach, one can't help but to see some of these parallels. Now, Tracy just talked about myth building, because that's basically what they've been doing. Myth building, the whole thing around Reagan. You don't have to be, you know, some graduate or some high level. You don't have to have more degrees than a thermometer to know that all of that hype around Reagan when he died was nothing but that. Just hype. Now, just recently, since we're talking about decisive leadership, unity building, quick decision making, just recently Bush actually came out in the papers and said, you know what? This war on terror that I done started and got y'all into, we can't win. That's what, fool just came out and gave it up. Come on, we can't win. In fact, we'll never win. But that's why we're going to have a permanent conflict forever. And you guys going to live under the yellow, the orange, and the red alerts. Forever. One would think that John... Oh, man, the Kerry might have got him on that or said something. But lately, he's been trying to outbush Bush. So therefore, once again, an opportunity is lost. But I'm not pushing Kerry. I can just tell you this here. Do you want to live under a regime in which civil liberties are shrinking daily? Yes or no? You don't have to be real sophisticated to get that one. Do you want to live under a regime reckless? He talk about the depleted uranium, but there's, look at, 1,000 and counting dead American soldiers, and they will never win because the Iraqis will never accept occupation. Okay?
And as long as you stay there, you can always give me a call at the West Oakland head coffin business that I started, because we have the business is booming. Now, next, Neil Cohen asked David Greenberg where these great war leaders' perceptions come from. So let's see what they say. Check this out.
Where do these conceptions come from? I mean, of course, our first president, a couple of minor things aside. I mean, he wasn't president during wartime, but we certainly think of George Washington as a war leader.
Certainly, and there have been many generals throughout history who have served as president, Andrew Jackson and up through Dwight Eisenhower. And I do think that, you know, in the absence of natural, other natural stepping stones for the presidency, basically governors, senators, and then generals or military leadership has been the other natural avenue. So it's not you know, it's not unnatural that we should associate these very prominent positions of national leadership coming out of the military with those that would also be suited to leading the country.
But the presidents that a lot of people might cite as their models of war presidents, Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I don't think either of them served in the military.
No, that's correct. Although FDR did have experience as an assistant secretary of the Navy in the Wilson administration, and so he had been through World War One in an important administrative capacity. So in a way, that does count for wartime experience.
Now, once again, what in essence they're trying to do, along with other things, is to play on the fear, the whole threat type of stuff. Because if a war is going on, quote unquote, that means crisis to many people. So what they want you then to do is to wave that flag unflinchingly. And that, in essence, serves the ruling class interest. If you take a look at some of the conditions and the role that the ruling class and even the presidents played in the early stages of World War II before the U.S. got into it. Many of them, before the major war started, made various pacts along with the ruling class, from Prescott Bush, who became basically a money holder for Nazis before and after the war. You had General Electric, you had Henry Ford. As I stated before, all one has to do is read Henry Ford and the Jews, and it outlines Henry's connections with the Nazis, them giving them the Iron Cross, him writing books like International Jew, so on and so forth, him keeping his plants open while the war was going on. Standard Oil
in Germany.
Standard Oil showing the Nazis how to make various fuels into aviation fuel to help the cause, so on and so forth. And all the while, the U.S. ruling class was making a decision to put its financial and other backing behind Hitler to help crush the working class that was fighting in Germany at the time. So were both the Democrats and Republicans, and of course, whatever raggedy president happened to be in office. Now, so many of those stages for future capitalist war were being set in place then. So then the capitalists plunged the world into a World War II, and then they want you to obediently get locked in goose-stepped fashion behind their war efforts. And as Smedley Butler has said and written, the legendary Brigadier General, it's just all for fat cats and the war profiteers. And in his legendary book, he outlines all of the various corporations that have made the super profit at the working class masses' expense. So this war presidency concept is in essence a mythology built up to help serve the overall interest of the ruling class, so that the masses of the working class look through themselves and through the eyes and at the eyes of the servant, the president of the ruling class, as being in the same interest.
That's right.
When of course it's not.
And in order for that to occur, believe it or not, there is a certain educational level that one has to attain. And I'm not talking about degrees here. Once again, you don't need more degrees than a thermometer. Maybe if you pick up the newspaper once a week, as bad as the press is, you might know a little bit more than most Americans today know. I was listening to the radio the other day, Tracy. The guy says, I support President Bush up and down the line on every issue. Hardcore. So one thinks. Then he says, and I listen to Fox Radio and only Fox Radio. And I said to myself, well, you know that got to be an ignorant SOB if that's all he's listening to. Well, unfortunately, homeboy is not alone. There's a lot of people going to go there and vote. And here is where they stand in terms of knowledge of the world and their country. 85% of Americans cannot name the Chief Justice of the United States. 85%. 69% of Americans believe the White House claims in September of 2003 that Saddam Hussein was personally involved in the 11th of September attacks. 69%. That's a lot of people. 34% of Americans believe on June of 2003 that Saddam's, quote, weapons of mass destruction had been found. They thought they already found them. Oh, man. Now, this is sad,
and
man.
And some of the ways this was happening is that while this issue was heating up about there not being found weapons of mass destruction, which basically died down, mm-hmm. but at one time it was heating up, you would see various people on, CNN's Crossfire, you know, the guys on the so-called right, they're all right, but, you know, the U.S. government's going to come out with a finding in a couple
any
of weeks.
Any day now.
I've been told this by forces that are out there. And they would just, they constantly would throw those types of phrases out, you know, to hold back. Instead of the person who was supposed to be arguing with them to say, show me now, you know, that it would get them to kind of hold back.
Retreat.
And there would be nothing found, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you know, 4 weeks, let it go. The only thing you can find around Iraq is this, some of the head coffins I sent over there, you know, for my business. But outside of them, you ain't finding nothing. No other nuggets, you know.
But listen, it gets worse. 22% of Americans believe, and that was in May of 2003, that Saddam had used his weapons of mass destruction on the U.S. forces. See, that's why they're all gone. See, it's all figured out. They understand. 85% of American young adults cannot find Afghanistan, Iraq, or Israel on a map. 30% of American young adults cannot find the Pacific Ocean on a map. 75% of American young adults do not know the population of the United States. 11% of young American adults cannot find the United States on a world map. 30% of Americans who believe that, well, politics and government are too complicated to understand. Brothers and sisters, we have serious work to perform, and part of it will be educational.
A good part of it, a core of it, because, you know, you have a gumpified population that is very consumer-driven, image-driven, and bases self-worth and stuff like that off of this kind of imagery type thing. If you watch, like, MTV, when they first started this whole real world thing, where, you know, they get various people and they would come on.
Yeah.
And, you know, they live together for a while, fight, this, act up, you know, and kind of show themselves off, you know, and all of that type of stuff. When the show first started, they would try to get interesting people, you know, somewhat interesting in, you know, kind of a this day and age bourgeois, you know, guy who's a musician, someone who's an artist, you know. So, like, when they had the Real World in San Francisco, they got this one brother, he was a musician. They got another dude who was gay and was an AIDS activist. Got this other guy who wanted to be a cartoonist. Got this other girl who was kind of into politics, you know, so on and so forth. So they had all these various people. Now, that's in this shorter time.
They didn't use them all up.
No. Now it's out of fashion. You know, now it's out of fashion to be overly opinionated or overly committed to something, you know, to be down with a cause. Just go out and just have fun, you know, so on and so forth. So what has ended up happening is now the show, you often just have a bunch of gumps who aren't going to do anything but fight because they ain't doing nothing else with their lives. You know, the reason why the Puck character, who is this little punk, you know, from San Francisco, you know, kind of rode a bike around as a job but lost that job. He never had anything to do. So you could see he was spending his time around the house trying to cause conflict. He became like this kind of mythological character. But many people miss the fact is because he was so disorientated and non-committal of anything productive in his life, you know, that this is, you know, he's just a little problem child type thing. Now, often, this is what they try to go after. So if you got some talent, you passionate about something, you down with the cause, don't plan on coming or getting on their little weak shit. So this sends out messages, you know, that often some of these little silly movies put out, you know, Dumb and Dumber and all of that type of stuff, you know, the Gumpification of America, in essence.
That's right.
Now, next, the host is a call by a guy named Alan from Denver, and he asked about, what about a president that's not into all of this war presidency, just wants to bring the troops home? So let's see how they deal with this. Check this out.
Get a call in. Alan joins us from San Diego.
Hi, Neil. It's unfortunate that there's not really a viable candidate that's clearly articulated that it's time to end the war and the occupation of Iraq and bring our troops back home to their families and loved ones right here in the United States.
Well, I assume you're dismissing the viability of Mr. Dayton.
Well, you know, at the very least, the men and women of the military deserve to have competent leadership. And with new leadership, with a leader who will honestly assess the current situation in Iraq without the baggage of the original pretext for this war, then we can move forward and get our troops back home where they deserve to be.
Alan, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
And his call raises a question, Robert Dalek. Have there been successful peace candidates? I guess going back to George McClellan, who wanted to make concessions to the South.
Yeah. They certainly become important in presidential campaigns when there is the feeling or fear that the war is stuck or that we're vulnerable somehow. And as David mentioned before, and he's quite right, Lincoln was quite vulnerable in 1864 until there were a series of victories shortly before the November 1864 election. So peace candidates, indeed in 1968, Eugene McCarthy and then Robert Kennedy, they were brilliantly effective and in essence forced Lyndon Johnson to quit. Eisenhower was very effective that way. In 1952, he didn't say he'd end the Korean War, but he promised to go to Korea, and what was implicit in that was he was a military man who would know how to end the war, and Harry Truman was stuck there and didn't know how to do it.
And then there is the curious case of President Richard Nixon, who actually campaigned twice as a man who, with a plan to end the war. Let's listen to Richard Nixon back in 1969.
After 5 years of Americans going into Vietnam, we are finally bringing American men home. By December 15, over 60,000 men will have been withdrawn from South Vietnam, including 20% of all of our combat forces. Let me now turn to our program for the future. We have adopted a plan, which we have worked out in cooperation with the South Vietnamese, for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces and their replacement by South Vietnamese forces on an orderly scheduled timetable.
Vietnamization, as it was known, would not succeed David Greenberg, but in I guess I've only left you 30 seconds, but Richard Nixon as peace president.
Well, he certainly ran twice as a peace president, but he skillfully split the difference by having his program be, his slogan be, peace with honor. So it wasn't immediate withdrawal the way McGovern talked about in 1972, but it was, you know, a patient peace, a negotiated peace, a peace that would retain America standing in that Cold War time.
Now you can see in why, in part, we're doing this segment and how the corporate media plays into this mythological stuff. You heard this whole thing about how they started off with the war presidency stuff. Then they move over about, is there and has there been successful peace presidencies? And then they talk about Nixon. Nixon was a lion presidency, which basically is what Boy George is too. Now, but since the corporate media is in cahoots, they just want to slap on these little labels, peace president, war president, and these have connotations. You know, the war president means you're being a strong, tough on terrorism, tough on the communists, tough on narco-terrorism, tough on Latin expansionism, all of this warmongering type of stuff that is just basically a justification for imperial expansionism and stuff. So and the corporate media wants you to get locked into these particular labels and not analyze that, you know, even when they try to smooth it out, that Nixon was trying to remove people slowly, i.e. peace with honor. You know, these are just contradictory terms, and it's like the whole POW-MIA. In every war, you have people MIA. Missing in action. Every war is going to have some people who are not going to be found. But by putting the slogan POW, i.e. prisoner of war, / MIA, as if saying they're connected, and that if you can't find them, then they're either a prisoner of war. This is all part of the whole myth type of thing that keeps this whole thing just going on and on about Vietnam. And the corporate media plays its part in playing into these particular labels. They don't try to deconstruct the labels. They want these soundbite types of mechanisms to be able to be thrown out there so that it makes the whole job of labeling and politics, bourgeois politics, that much easier.
You know what? I guess here you go. How do you know if George Bush is lying? Answer: if he's talking, he's lying. You know, after running his mouth in that crappy little speech he gave Thursday night, you know, one name never came up? Osama bin Laden. Of course, no one notices it because, well, that's then, and this is no. Remember all that? And we will find you under every rock, under every... Hey, Cheney, what you doing under that rock? Come on out from under there, boy. Look, this is just foolishness. Peace with honor, huh? Well, let me tell you what peace with honor looked like at the time. And sometimes it's nice to be around for a while. As the Viet Cong started marching on Saigon, and it became clear that this was it was over. Here's peace with honor. The CIA and the military brass began to run to the few little helicopters that were left, particularly on top of the U.S. embassy, I'll never forget this, and started to kick old ladies out the way, knock children out the way, and just grab onto some part of that helicopter so they could get on out of Dodge. And you just watched them panic and trip over each other. Like the cowards they were. They're great at interrogating, torturing Vietnamese prisoners that were with their hands tied behind their back. But as those people started to encircle that embassy, the ringing of revolution started to engulf that. I tell you what, I wish you got to get a film of that to see peace with honor at work. You see? Because it was anything but honorable. And in fact, I'm telling you now, they talking about, oh no, we're not going to cut and run this time. I'm telling you now, working class brothers and sisters, that's our slogan. Cut and run now.
Now that we've heard some opinion on what this whole war president image stuff is supposed to be about, let's hear right from the jackal's mouth. Check this out.
When I said those words 4 years ago, none of us could have envisioned what these years would bring. In the heart of this great city, we saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning. We saw the bravery of rescuers grow with danger. We learned of passengers on a doomed plane who died with a courage that frightened their killers. We have seen a shaken economy rise to its feet. And we have seen Americans in uniform storming mountain strongholds and charging through sandstorms and liberating millions with acts of valor that would make the men of Normandy proud.
Now that's classic war presidency demagoguery. I mean, all of this rhetoric about how you saw U.S. passengers apply a courage that frightened their killers. What the hell are you talking about? When their killers were shooting their planes into buildings, what the hell are they frightened about? I mean, this is rhetoric. And these drones...
Dumb rhetoric.
These drones, it's almost like they can make a Hollywood movie and this create these Arabs being scared, you know, these mythological Arabs
as
they're about to crash into the plane because they're so frightened by the courage displayed by the Americanos. This is something you only see in Rambo movies. And this is basically what he's doing. He's putting on a Rambo show, a Rocky 5, 6, you know, 100 show, you know, Rocky winning the title and all that. This is this American mythology type stuff. No essence of truth whatsoever. And this pushing, once again, what this war presidency stuff supposed to symbolize. Courage, resolve, commitment. You know, that's if you listen, that's what he was doing. He was pushing the buttons that the people who before were talking about war presidency and what that's supposed to represent. Boy George was pushing those exact same buttons that they were mentioning. Now, this was two different shows. You know, this the show on NPR, Talk of the Nation, that I played for you first. This was even before the whole Republican National Convention. They were just talking about the whole manifestation of the war presidency image in a history of America. And then there you see Boy George playing out this mythological John Wayne role. And for many people, hey, it's a good chance he may get elected. It's working.
No, it is a good chance. And that's why... That's the thing that, you know, why this ain't really funny. But otherwise, it's hilarious in some ways. I mean...
Well, I mean, if bombs weren't raining down on Iraqi people,
right.
You know, and basically the earth in crisis from an ecological standpoint to a humanitarian standpoint, the capitalists are trying all forms of global expansionism and war domination to maintain their grip on the world, and basically is putting a whole lot of things in peril right now. And unfortunately, a large segment of the working class is being swayed by the rhetoric of both parties and fighting amongst themselves about which way to go forward when both of them are getting bulked off the elephant and bulked off the donkey and trampled over.
Forget the donkey. Forget the ass. Forget the elephant. Build your own damn party. A party of the working class. That's what we need. You know, when we say if he's talking, if Bush is talking, he's lying. Here's an instance right here. This fool, this idiot, there's one, you know, sometimes you can you get carried away with your little speech and you're talking about wisdoms of the universe or whatever. When you start talking about reality, that had risen to its peak under his stewardship. Now, I don't think much of Crime Bill. I hope he had a good time when he was, you know, when he was on a roll. But I mean, here's a situation where you could see between, let's say, 1998 and 2000, the economy was rather hot. I would argue with you, it has little to do with who's president, by the way. All right? We live in a system called capitalism. Give a damn who the president is. The economy goes up and down. But for this fool to talk about an America that's in a recession, basically, as the economy moving to its peak, and then look at it and people clap, that bothers me. No, I'm serious. That bothers me. Because it's so alien, so foreign from anything that could be interpreted as the truth.
Well, like I said before, the whole war presidency is based off of a mythological structure. So they're not really dealing with the facts on the ground or the interest that should be preeminent amongst the working classes. They are trying to push feel-good buttons that have you believe that as long as you wave the flag in a way that serves the interest of the nation overall, uncritically, then you are serving your interest. Whenever you do that without any kind of class analysis, you are setting yourself up to be befuddled by all types of rhetoric. You are setting yourself up to use slogans like lesser of two evils and anyone but Bush, yet Kerry's talking about adding 40,000 more troops. So in essence, you are playing yourself by getting into this sloganeering soundbite type of mythological imagery. Now next, Boyd talks about the next great steps ahead. Let's see what he means by that. Check this out.
Since 2001, Americans have been given hills to climb and found the strength to climb them. Now, because we have made the hard journey, we can see the valley below. Now, because we have faced challenges with resolve, we have historic goals within our reach and greatness in our future. We will build a safer world and a more hopeful America, and nothing will hold us back. In the work we have done and the work we will do, I am fortunate to have a superb vice president. I have counted on Dick Cheney's calm and steady judgment in difficult days, and I'm honored to have him at my side.
You know what? Did the fool just say that he's about to build a safer world? This, once again, I just, and people clap. Well, all right, it's true. This is staged. Now, look, both of these, the Democratic Party National Convention, Republican National Convention, were both staged and choreographed right down to the last Michael Jackson moonwalk. They all, you know, it was all set up. So these people, this applause, pay no attention to the applause. Listen, this is crap. Nobody in their right mind would clap when you say, when this man asserts that he's about to build a safer world. Let's look at the reality. I would argue that even in Iraq, it is no longer safer. As one of my colleagues just pointed out to me, they got a little green zone, so they kind of control the city of Baghdad. They got a few bases. If they step off of one of those bases, they're finished. They can't go nowhere.
Well, Robert Fisk has been talking about this for a while. Anyone has to do is read The Independent, and he's talking about how the green zone is getting smaller and smaller and how bombs are now finding their way into the particular green zone. But in part, since the corporate media is part of a myth-making apparatus and institution in line with the Pentagon, they're not going to give you these types of detail where reality would come slap into your face. So basically, they are going to promote this type of, illusionary imagery as much as possible. So when you hear like Boy George talk all of this type of stuff and people clapping, in many ways, it's part of a reflection of the poor state of the working class and the defeat in many ways of the working class. Mm-hmm. Those people who have put their hopes and dreams within the Democrat and Republican Party, you have then, by de facto, stripped yourself, at least at this moment, of making any kind of hard forced alignment with class conscious people to make real change. So then you become basically an appendage and at the mercy of the ruling class, because you have channeled out your working class ingredients of resistance and put them into, you've been hoodwinked and put them into a segment of society that is in direct opposition to your working class interests. Now, Boy George, while he's a buffoon and all of this type of stuff, once again, that's in part a reflection of how bad the working class has been beaten down. Because, you know, there was a time when you read stuff by like JFK, you know, some of the stuff he's written and all of that type of stuff, you can tell that those who were presidents, you know, the administrators for the ruling class, were at a much higher intellectual level. And in part, it's because they had different components they had to deal with. They had to deal with, you know, Russia. They had to deal with China. They had to deal with the Vietnam War. They had to deal with, you know, the Panthers and other political organizations and civil rights movements and, you know, people, you know, agitating and fighting all over, you know, at Che and all of them, you know, grumbling and running around South America and stuff like that. So you had to be on your feet. You had to do stuff like John F. Kennedy did when he read Che Guevara's book, Guerrilla Warfare. He said, you know what? We need an opposition to this. And that's when he instituted the Green Berets. It was his ideas and stuff. Now, of course, we know Boy George could never do anything like that. But in part, that's a reflection because they don't believe, at least at this particular time, they need the John F. Kennedy types anymore. Because so much of the working class nationally and internationally has been so crushed and demoralized. And what has taken its place are Osama bin Laden, you know, right-wing Islamic fundamentalist types, who often the CIA used and create to crush many of those social movements in the first place.
Exactly.
So now they can get these puppeteers like Boy George, who basically just use slogans and feel-good type stuff and don't have to really deal with the gritty grassroots level types of discourse that are happening in this country and around the world. They don't have to worry about, at this particular time, the social unrest that was taking place, like in Africa, in the Middle East, when at that, you know, during the, you know, 50s and 60s, they were throwing off the chains of colonialization and looking for new directions to go in. So, of course, you would need a president like an imperialist president like JFK to put together things like a Peace Corps, you know, and send bright-eyed American kids over there to give the image of the U.S. being something other than what it is, you know. So, once again, when we hear Boy George and these types of clowns speak, while I do clown them, I do also see that this is a reflection of something, and it is, in more than anything else for me, a reflection of how far we have to go.
Mm-hmm. Right. And just to look, build a safer world. Actually, I would argue quite the reverse, that the world today is measurably more dangerous. And how? Just by the number of terrorist incidents that take place in which people that are, you know, not directly involved in the conflict lose their lives. I'm talking about Chechnya. I'm talking about Palestine. I'm talking about all over the world. These type of incidents are on the rise, not the decline. Now, and by the way, he's making the world so safe that they can't step out their little green zones in a country that they're occupying.
And you know, in part, what I get out of that when he says making the world safer today. See, once again, that's this words that he's saying to a confused masses that has put their faith in those parties. See, in the past, when you had independent working class organizations in America and throughout the world, a raggedy president could not have just come out and said those types of sloganeering things, because many people were analyzing and often working with resistant movements to offset these imperial escapades that the U.S. Was involved in, and often critiquing these types of escapades that the U.S. Was involved in and had various social and political movements to combat it. Now you have much of the American working class caught in the matrix of the imperial system, believing that there is some kind of solution within the Democrat and Republican Party. So if you are confused to that extent, then a manipulator like Boy George can throw out this slogan about how, he didn't say he is, he said we are, like we're all in this together. You know, we're making the world safer. You know, so it gives the illusion that, well, yeah, some things are going good, even though I see all these head coffins coming back and, you know, all this unrest going on, that at least the thing I'm tied with is going good, even though what you're tied with is going nowhere at all. So once again, it's in part a reflection of the depravity of the situation that the working class, especially in America, is in at this time. Now, next, Boy George outlines how this election is on and will be on the issues of terrorism. So let's check out what Boy has to say. Dig this.
This election will also determine how America responds to the continuing danger of terrorism. And you know where I stand. Three days after September the 11th, I stood where Americans died, in the ruins of the Twin Towers. Workers in hard hats were shouting to me, whatever it takes. A fellow grabbed me by the arm and he said, do not let me down. Since that day, I wake up every morning thinking about how to better protect our country. I will never relent in defending America, whatever it takes.
You know, what's in part kind of pathetic about this, this is kind of like the westward expansion period in the 1800s. Now, the U.S. is turning the whole world into a giant Indian reservation, you know, a whole globalized hell on earth. But in the 1800s, in the 17 and 1800s especially, when the U.S. was liquidating the native population off of its land, you had many people who would go out into the Dakotas and stuff like that. And they didn't really have any kind of working class base or anything like that. But they were following this kind of Western expansionist myth and dream. So they would often occupy native land. Natives who were seeing themselves being genocided away, their buffalo being killed, etc., etc. So often, in response to this, Crazy Horse, Two Moon, Touch the Clouds, Rain in the Face, Gaul, Little Big Man would revolt. And what would happen amongst the white population that was expanding out into these areas? They would go turn to the government and they say, whatever it takes, Custer, whatever it takes. In other words, no class consciousness whatsoever, no connection that you're occupying someone else's land. This is now, as pathetic as it was, as you know, even cats like Frederick Douglass commented back then, as pathetic as it was back then, now to see this type of same thing and mentality go on amongst the American population in this day and age on a global level is, now that's some serious pathetic stuff. Now next, the war president describes why and how fighting this war on terrorism is his mission. Check this out.
So, we have fought the terrorists across the earth, not for pride, not for power, but because the lives of our citizens are at stake. Our strategy is clear. We've tripled funding for Homeland Security and trained 500,000 first responders because we're determined to protect our homeland. We're transforming our military and reforming and strengthening our intelligence services. We are staying on the offensive, striking terrorists abroad so we do not have to face them here at home. And we are working to advance liberty in the broader Middle East, because freedom will bring a future of hope and the peace we all want. And we will prevail. Our strategy is succeeding. 4 years ago, Afghanistan was the home base of Al-Qaeda. Pakistan was a transit point for terrorist groups. Saudi Arabia was fertile ground for terrorist fundraising. Libya was secretly pursuing nuclear weapons. Iraq was a gathering threat, and Al-Qaeda was largely unchallenged as it planned attacks.
If they were speaking German, I think you know what this would sound like, because this is kind of this like drone type of thing where they're just chanting at times before he even finished. It was like, regardless of what he said, we'll be behind you, faithful leader. You know, that's how things have deteriorated, where the obedience level and uncritical analysis about what is in your own kids' interest is this, for many people, laid out to rest. And once again, that's in part because people have put their fighting mechanisms and tools aside, many people, and have aligned their whole soul with these two parties who represent a ruling class that's diametrically in opposition to your own survival. Now, next, as we wrap this up, there's one last thing we have. And you heard let's first do this quick thing about the boy George describing how the whole Middle East is joining in on this journey of American freedom. Let's hear that right quick. Check this out.
Today, the government of a free Afghanistan is fighting terror. Pakistan is capturing terrorist leaders. Saudi Arabia is making raids and arrests. Libya is dismantling its weapons program. The army of a free Iraq is fighting for freedom. And more than three-quarters of Al-Qaeda's key members and associates have been detained or killed. We have led, many have joined, and America and the world are safer. This progress involves careful diplomacy, clear moral purpose, and some tough decisions. And the toughest came on Iraq. We knew Saddam Hussein's record of aggression and support for terror. We knew his long history of pursuing, even using, weapons of mass destruction. And we know that September the 11th requires our country to think differently. We must and we will confront threats to America before it is too late.
So once again, all you heard from Boy George was the whole code of the whole imagery, mythological imagery of a war president. Strong, confident, resolved, pushing buttons, talking about issues like the Iraqi army is fighting for freedom and stuff. They're running for their damn lives. Many of them are joining the other side. They realize they better if they want to live. But we're not dealing with reality. So you just push buttons and sloganeer in this mythological construct. Now, the last thing to show how this myth is deeply rooted in the American way of life, here this author who wrote a book about called The Fool Rudy talks about how Rudolph Giuliani, you know, the former mayor, who was basically being looked at as a buffoon on September 10th, he became the war mayor, and his image has changed all over the world to the point where now he's considered, or at least this country, he's considered the America's mayor. Check this out.
I felt I was watching a bait and switch operation at a masquerade ball. This is made me a little dizzy. It gave me vertigo to see such a distortion of reality, because those of us who lived here under Rudy Giuliani, we saw him trash the First Amendment by trying to defund a museum for hanging a picture he didn't approve of. We saw him scapegoat the homeless. We saw him racially divide the city. He is not really a moderate, except on social issues like abortion rights, gay rights, immigrant rights, and gun control. He is basically a right winger on most issues, but the Republican Party needed the illusion of his moderation tied to the bogus notion that he was the hero of 9/11 when all he did was do his job. He didn't pull anybody out of the rubble. He didn't climb up the stairs and carry anybody down on his back like a firefighter. He didn't dig for bodies in the wreckage like a lot of construction workers and volunteers did. He just did his job. The day on September 10th, 2001, he had a 40% approval rating. He was being laughed out of town. He was flaunting his adultery with his soon-to-be third wife. And suddenly, because he stood in front of a camera for a week after the atrocity of 9/11, he reinvented himself.
That says it in a nutshell. Giuliani had 40% approval rating on September 10th. He was running around flaunting his adultery. I saw some of those articles where he was staying at some little mansion with his little, you know, new girlfriend while still married, you know, and so on and so forth. And, you know, people in New York called themselves being in the uproar about it and stuff. And then people were looking at him like he was crazy because he wanted to defund the museum because he didn't like the picture that they had. But then on September 11th, he stands in front of the camera, like the cat says, taking a bunch of pictures, you know, with a stone face on, and he becomes the mythological war mayor hero man.
Instantly.
And this gets into the psyche of the masses of people in America. That's in part what this is really about. When all of a sudden, many people can flip and then raise this bum up too to some kind of Achilles type status, you know, as if he's just some kind of raw warrior, you know, because he's taken a couple of pictures and did nothing else, you know.
Ran in front of the camera. That took some, you know, he had to hurry up.
Right. A lot of them just came to him. Shows that part of this war presidency and war mayor stuff is deeply part of the American mythological imagery that American people, at least a certain segment of the society, love to hold so dearly, John Wayne style. Hold on a sec. Thank you. Well, that's just going to about wrap it up for tonight. As it's clear that beyond other things, these fools are on, besides their pathetic fantasy, is that they're also dancing on cloud nine. Well, we're going to have to shoot them off that cloud and put them under the ground for good. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.
Another chair beside me. We hardly had enough food or room to sleep. It was hard time. Needed something to eat, my troubled man. Listen, my father didn't know the meaning of work. He disrespected mama and treated us like dirt. I left home seeking a job that I never did find. Depressed and downhearted, I took the cloud nine. I'm doing fine up here on cloud nine. Listen, one more time, I'm doing fine up here on cloud nine.